You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Sports, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Paul Knepper, and today we'll be talking to Carlos Acevedo about his new book, The Duke, The Life and Lies of Tommy Morrison. Carlos is an award-winning boxing writer. His work has appeared in several publications, including Inside HBO Boxing, Undisputed Champion Network, Boxing News, Boxing Digest, and other places as well. Carlos, welcome to the show.
Hey, Paul. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you for coming on. Carlos, this book is just shockingly disturbing. and I learned so much about kind of the underbelly of professional boxing. I mean, I think everyone kind of knows that boxing is corrupt in certain ways and certainly shady. But the depth of it was startling to me to some extent. And we'll get into all that, but can you start us off by talking a little bit about Tommy Morrison's background? Where did he come from? What, you know, his family, that kind of stuff.
Well, Tommy Morrison came from a very, very small town called Jay, Oklahoma, which at the time he was living there, had a population of about 2,000, give or take. So it was sort of that John Cougar Mellencamp, I was born in a small town kind of thing. And he had a pretty harrowing background. His parents split up. His mother was charged with murder for accidentally killing her husband's mistress at a bar. So, you know, Tommy had a sort of, you know, catch as can be life style growing up. And, you know, when he was 13 years old, his parents decided to stick him in tough man contests, which is just, it's astonishing to think about that. You know, they forged an ID. He didn't look like he was 18 years old at all, but they forged an ID. You know, his mom gave him a tattoo when he was 10 or 13 years old to make him look older. And so he was in this tough man circuit for a couple of years, fighting grown truck drivers, fighting bouncers, fighting, you know, construction workers, bikers, etc. And, you know, that sort of led him into the world of boxing. And there's this whole point of, like, he had this strange background, this patchwork background. His father was an alcoholic. His father was abusive. His parents split up. And from there, he went to tough man contests, and then onto the crazy world of professional boxing, where nothing is as it seems and it's completely seamy. So it's sort of fitting that he went on from one strange thing to another as a young man.
Yeah, I found the whole, put aside the fact that he was 13 years old and so young, and how, I mean, that sounds, frankly, sounds like child abuse to me. just the whole that whole world of the tough man contests in general. I didn't know much about that. Can you talk a little bit about a little more about those contests? What that was all about?
Well, tough man contests were that was a fad in the early 80s. I even made a movie, a Hollywood movie out of it, starring Dennis Quaid. And it took hold in the Southeast and in the Midwest during the 80s when there was a pretty big recession going on. So, you know, people needed money. And some of the more daredevil types or some of the more drunk types, you know, got into these not even organized tournaments where last man standing is the guy who wins the total prize. So Tommy sometimes got as much as $1,000 for winning a tough man tournament. And according to Tommy, he won all of his tough man fights except for one. So it was a pretty bizarre scene. You know, it was like a combination of Hooters and blood sport, you know, so it was pretty crazy. And I think you're right. I mean, that is sort of, if you look at it now, it seems sort of abusive to put a child into that. But the truth is, he could handle himself because he had years of amateur experience behind him.
Right. Was that path common at that time? Were there a lot of people who kind of jumped from the tough guy contest, the tough man contest, to professional boxing?
No, not at all. I think the most successful professional boxer who came out of that scene was 80s lightweight Greg Haugen, who was lightweight champion, I think, twice. He had a famous trilogy with Vinny Pazienza in the 80s, and he was famously beat up by Julio Cesar Chavez in front of supposedly 100,000 fans at a bullfight arena in Mexico. So no, it takes a lot of discipline and talent to be a professional boxer. And most of these tough guys were nothing like that. I mean, the other famous tough guy fighter, I think, was Butterbean. And Chrissy Martin was a tough guy, a tough girl, tough gal. And Grady Brewer, who I think won the prize fighter tournament one year. He was a tough man fighter, but no, this is not the way to become a professional prize fighter. Definitely not.
You know, it's incredible reading your book. You said before how in the world of professional boxing, nothing is as it seems. And, you know, I think all of us know that on some level. I'm not a big boxing fan, a somewhat casual boxing fan. I have to admit, reading your book, I didn't really understand the depth of it. And it's fascinating how Tommy's just whole persona was a complete mirage. I mean, starting with this story that he was related to John Wayne. Can you talk a little bit about the kind of cultivation of Tommy's image?
Well, yeah, this is an interesting thing. I mean, Tommy was genuinely who he appeared to be on camera and in the newspapers, right? Especially in the police blotters and in the headlines.
Right.
He made in his last, you know, he was genuinely a reckless, tough guy. He loved to party. That was really him. As far as his image in boxing, that was mostly Bill Caton, his co-manager. And Bill Caton had a lot of connections. He was a co-manager of Mike Tyson in the 80s, along with Jimmy Jacobs. And Bill Caton could get you commercial sponsorships. He can get you on TV. And he had a real knack for publicity. And so just the name Morrison was enough for Caton to roll with that ball. Because in conversation, Tommy seemingly dropped the fact that he might have been related to John Wayne. And so, you know, Bill Caton just ran with that. And that's the first sign that Tommy was more publicity than a potential world champion at that time. You know, he was very talented. Tommy Morrison was very talented. So there are people who deny that on the one hand, and there are people who exaggerate his talent on the other. But, you know, he was not related to John Wayne. I spoke to his uncle, Troy Morrison, and Troy told me that, you know, I guess a grandfather, a Morrison grandfather met another Morrison, and, you know, it was just talk. So it's sort of like family lore. But no, he wasn't related to the real Duke.
You know, you talk, obviously, in the book, you go into depth about just the Great White Hope phenomena. How much was that a part of Tommy's persona?
Well, that's an interesting question. The White Hope angle essentially existed independently of Tommy Morrison. That was not something he ever really emphasized during his career. There were a few interviews where Morrison acknowledged that being white was advantageous, which it is, at that time especially. But overall, he downplayed its significance, right? But there's sort of this, like, sporting equivalent to the collective unconscious or something where, you know, people intrinsically saw him as that. And that included his management. So, you know, I guess that makes sense that people would immediately associate him with the White Hope story, because people tend to identify with boxers. So was the White Hope playbook put into effect by his management? Yes, I think so. That's pretty evident. But Tommy also succeeded in a way that his predecessors never did, right? When you think of White Hopes, you think of really bad fighters. Right? But, you know, before Jerry Cooney came around in 1980, in the early 80s from Long Island, you know, white heavyweights had that designation of being White Hopes, but they were also contenders, right? They had a fight. They clawed themselves into ratings. They were part of the boxing rat race. They were in the mix, basically, looking for paydays, right? So you think of someone like Scott Ledoux. He had like 7 or 8 losses before he fought Larry Holmes for the title. You know, Jerry Quarry is probably the best example of a White Hope who was not built up. He fought just about every heavyweight that mattered for nearly a decade. But then you have like the marginal figures like Lee Canalito or Richie Melito, Ty Fields, right? And then you have like at the bottom of the barrel, you have like the New York Jet linebacker, Mark Gastineau.
Right.
So Jerry Cooney set the template of fighting, I don't want to say nobodies, but, you know, fighting marginal talents and to put himself in a position to get a giant payday. Right. But Morrison was a little better than that. Right. He went beyond those guys. First, he beat George Foreman, of course, and he commanded the spotlight on his own. You know, he was a big ratings draw. He was also a box office attraction in the Midwest and in the Southeast. So, you know, the White Hope thing was a management maneuver, and Morrison really was not interested in that, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure many of our listeners, of course, know Tommy as Tommy the Machine Gun from Rocky V. How did he land that role?
Well, you know, for almost every fact, you know, you have to put facts in quotation marks, I guess. But for every fact, there's like several competing narratives about how this happened, how that happens. So, you know, Tommy and Rocky, the two stories that are most out there are Frank Stallone was watching TV one night, and Frank Stallone saw Tommy knock somebody out, and Frank Stallone called his brother Sly because Sly needed to cast somebody for Rocky V. That's one story. And the other story is that it was Sly Stallone who was watching TV and decided this guy might be, you know, Tommy might be good for the part. But I think the real story is Bill Caton. Again, it goes back to Bill Caton. He was a master publicist, and he also had a thing about sending tapes, videotapes of his fighters to the media. And he's exactly the kind of guy who would send a videotape to Sylvester Stallone and say, hey, check this out. I think he might be good for your movie. And so Stallone watched the tape, and they flew Tommy out for a screen test, and he got the part.
Yeah, I think he played it pretty well too, and you know, it wasn't the greatest Rocky movie, but you know, it was. I think he carried himself well.
That movie was terrible.
Yeah, okay, you said it, not me. Yeah, no, you're right.
That's gonna get me in trouble, but what are you gonna do, right? I mean,
yeah,
it was like a multi Golden Raspberry Award winner. And the biggest indictment about Rocky V, other than it was bad, was they stopped making Rockies for like 15, 16 years.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. everyone was like, okay, it's enough.
They were like, you know what, forget this. And so it took like 16 more years for the Rocky franchise to reboot.
Right.
But Tommy wasn't bad at it. He definitely wasn't bad at it. I mean, I wrote in the Duke that he was better than Sugar Ray Robinson and Jake LaMotta in their movies.
Okay.
And Rocky Rose, right. Yeah. Right. So that's a plus.
Yeah. You know, you touched on it before, and frankly, I like the way you started the book with kind of laying out that look with Tommy Morrison, it's so difficult because he lied, and you know, certainly towards the end of his life appeared to be delusional, and it was so hard to separate fact from fiction and who was Tommy Morrison and what was real and what wasn't. And part of this mirage was, you know, building him up through fighting nobodies, you know. I mean, a couple of the examples, it was like, it seemed like they just grabbed a bum off the street and threw him in the ring with him. And that kind of burnished his record and to an extent his reputation and helped him get some of his big paydays. And yet he had these moments in the ring, and he had, you know, this incredible left hook that you talk about. So how good of a fighter was Tommy Morrison?
Well, Tommy Morrison, first and foremost, was exciting. There were reasons why he drew a mass audience. One of them was that he was white. That's for sure. You know, he had a constituency. The other was he was very, very exciting fighter. You never knew what was going to happen in a Tommy Morrison fight. Sometimes even against the opponents that were, you know, meant to just fall over at the first, you know, opportunity, right? So he was a good athlete. In high school, supposedly, we never know about these things when we talk about Tommy Morrison, but supposedly he was a good football player. He played baseball. He played basketball. And supposedly he got a scholarship offer from, I guess it was Emporia University. And so he was a very good athlete. And his left hook was legitimate. He could knock out even very good fighters with a left hook. Had he gotten the opportunity to actually land a left hook against a good fighter. And he did against Ray Mercer, but Ray Mercer was almost inhuman. So Tommy could fight, and he had really fast hands. He had the fastest hands of any heavyweight for his era, other than Tyson and Evander Holyfield. And Holyfield was like a machine with combination punches. So Tommy was talented, right? But his defense was poor. He didn't have the greatest mobility. And he, obviously, one of his main problems was he was not in condition most of the time. He was never at his peak condition. The closest he got to peak condition was when he won a decision against George Foreman in 1993. That was about it. But, you know, he's not underrated. People will tell you that he's underrated, you know, because in boxing, you go by the record as much as you can. You have to add the asterisks as you go along in boxing. But, you know, Tommy was not underrated. He got as far as he could. And even if he was, you know, a monk, I think his limitations would have kept him where he was. His chin was pretty shaky, but he was always exciting to watch. You know, when he knocked out people, even the marginal talents that he fought, you know, on ESPN and the USA Network. I mean, there was a fun, kitschy aspect to seeing him bounce somebody off the canvas with the left hook, even though you knew deep in your heart that it wasn't really a competitive contest. But Tommy could definitely fight.
I mean, really, you just touched on it. The crowning achievement of his career was the win over George Foreman. And, you know, you talk in the book about it at that point, and obviously George was old at that time. And you talk in the book about how he, you know, was known to, frankly, avoid the biggest contenders, the biggest threats to him at that point. So how impressive was that victory over George at that time?
Well, it's an accomplishment you can't take away from Tommy Morrison, you know, because he has his detractors. He also has some really rabid, delusional supporters. But you can't take away his win from Foreman, because Foreman in his next fight went on to win the lineal real heavyweight championship of the world against Michael Moore. Yet George was almost twice as old as Tommy Morrison. So, and George never looked good post Evander Holyfield, except against Michael Moore. And he chased Michael Moore down because he saw something in Michael Moore that he thought he could take advantage of, which was, in his mind, he thought that Michael Moore was psychically weak. And I think he also questioned his chin. So George Foreman actually tried to sue the sanctioning body to get a fight with George, Michael Moore. But going back to Tommy, when Tommy defeated Foreman, the press was not very, you know, impressed. They really dogged him for this fight, because he essentially ran around the ring. He had this footloose strategy, which was calculated to keep Foreman off balance. And it wasn't the greatest performance at that time. People didn't consider it such a thing. But, you know, I thought it was a pretty decent fight for heavyweights. And I thought, you know, he put in a good strategy. He did what he had to do to win. And even though he heard the boos, he got the WBO title, which didn't mean much at the time. He got the payday, and more important, he secured his immediate future by beating Foreman. But it wasn't a bad fight.
Right. The Foreman fight seemed the exception in a way, in that it seems in the book that, like, whenever Tommy was about to make a big breakthrough in his career, somehow he kind of got in his own way. Whether it was insufficient training, or when he, you know, kind of inexplicably scheduled another fight before his big payday with Lennox Lewis. And you talk in the book too about, you know, it seems like he had some issues with anxiety before and during fights. There was kind of this self-destructive, kind of self-sabotaging aspect to his career. Where do you think that came from? Was that fueled by self-doubt?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I don't get into it too much in the book, but I think he did have some kind of, I don't know what, success anxiety. It seemed to me that he could have done better. He might not have gotten as far as, like, the real championship, but he could have done better. But he did sabotage himself at every turn. According to John Brown, his first trainer, you know, Tommy Pardee before the Ray Mercer fight, which was his biggest fight to date. You know, Ray Mercer was the only non-stiff that Tommy Morrison fought up to that point. And he still went to a 38 special concert beforehand. And according to John Brown, he took ecstasy and he was partying and hanging out. And you don't want to do that with a guy like Ray Mercer. And you know, Mercer proved it by, he almost killed Tommy Morrison in the ring. So there is something to that, I think. You know, he's a small town guy. Maybe he thought he was where he belonged, right? Reminds me of Charles Williams' line from the novel The Hot Spot, where the narrator, I think the last line is, you know, I found my level and I'm living it. And so Tommy, really? Yeah, right. I mean, like, even when he was a Hollywood guy, Tommy didn't hang out in Hollywood. You know, he stayed in Kansas City. He stayed in Jay, Oklahoma. You know, so it didn't look like he seemed not just interested, but maybe he didn't feel like he belonged among this sort of celebrity jet set culture. And maybe he didn't want it. But, you know, it does seem odd that he kept losing at inopportune moments, basically. You know, there might be something psychic there.
Yeah. Do you think Tommy loved boxing?
Well, Tommy was good at it. At his level, he was good at boxing. He was sort of a forthcoming guy at some point. So it was hard always to separate fact and fiction from what he said. But he did say that he felt he was going to be burned out young, because of his style. He was very aggressive style, and he took a lot of punishment in sparring to develop that style. Now, that style is is very hard to keep up. And so at certain points, he said he was exhausted from training. He was tired of training. And this is a guy who didn't train all out. Supposedly, he did when he was actually in the ring, in the gym, but he wasn't in the gym enough. So, you know, I think he had mixed feelings about it. But at the same time, you know, boxing is what gave him his identity. And we saw that when it was all over for him, when he was diagnosed with HIV, he could no longer fight until he made his crazy comeback in 2007. So, you know, it's every fighter has that need to be in the ring because their identity is so bound up in it. But Tommy sometimes did seem ambiguous about boxing and his career in general.
Yeah.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
There's a point in the book where you write very eloquently about this notion of the shot fighter. When it, you know, it's obvious that his best days are behind him. And Morrison, of course, kept going in the ring after that, as most fighters do. Do you think he realized at a certain point that he was never going to be a champion again or a top contender again? Or is that when kind of the delusion started?
Well, the thing about Tommy is that he was always going to make money. And as long as he didn't keep losing like consecutive fights or whatever, he was basically forced to continue his career because he was a moneymaker. And because he was exciting and heavyweight with the big punch, he was always going to be in demand. So there was never an issue of him trying to pick up the pieces from every loss. You know, but the problem with Tommy in general was like after every loss, the competition got progressively worse, the opposition. So he was always, and his team, they were always thinking about how can we rebuild to put ourselves back in a position to make $500,000, $1 million, you know, $2 million, right? And his competition got steadily, steadily worse. And, you know, and none of this, by the way, should be upsetting or surprising to anybody, but like the most stubborn Tommy partisan, you know, people say, oh, his quality of opposition was great or better than you say it was, but you know, his own matchmaker quit because of the opponents, right? Like Peyton Scherer was a respected veteran and he quit because of how, you know, they ignored his advice and kept fighting low level guys, you know, in Las Vegas where you can gamble on whether the sun is going to rise, right? They refused to post odds on several of his fights. So, you know, and the contemporary press at the time, which is, you know, far more independent back then than it is now, they shredded him for his opposition. So as long as he was going to keep fighting knockovers, there was always a chance he could rebuild himself, manufacture himself again as a redempted heavyweight.
We've been talking mostly about what went on inside the ring, though I would argue the most interesting part of Tommy's life and is what went on outside of it and what came to be the lies of his life, really. I guess we'll start, you know, you talked a little bit about his partying, which was pretty epic. Can you go into a little more detail about his lifestyle outside of the ring?
Well, Tommy Morrison was like the Wilt Chamberlain of boxing, essentially. He was a real womanizer in a way that the average person just won't understand, I think. In later years, he would brag about his sexual conquests. And he said that, you know, he slept with, you know, 5 women a night sometimes, which is crazy and exhausting. And no wonder he was never in shape for a fight. So, you know, a lot of the salacious details I got from his second ex-wife's memoir. And she goes into, you know, I get, what would you call them? Trains and the orgies and stuff like that. She even told a story about how they checked into a hotel and Tommy left for a little while. And when he came back, she found out that he had just had a trio with some other people in the hotel. And it's just crazy. And that's really debilitating for a fighter. And Tommy was also a serious drinker. Drugs were not that prominent in his life, but he did dabble in ecstasy and, according to some, cocaine. John Brown said that he definitely used ecstasy before the Mercer fight. So Tommy was just out of control. He was young, reckless, good-looking guy, so he just wanted to party. The responsibilities of the ring, the discipline needed, I guess that was for the future for him, but the future never came.
Then, of course, there was the HIV diagnosis in 1996, I believe it was, and the crazy aftermath to that. Can you talk a little bit about how Tommy initially responded to being HIV positive and how that changed over time?
Well, Tommy was diagnosed with HIV in February 1996. I think it was February 10th. Just a few hours before he was supposed to fight on a Showtime televised card. We can all imagine that it was devastating, a devastating thing to hear. And of course, he was in shock. Although you do hear that he suspected that he had HIV all along and that somehow he got away with it coming out because he fought in commission in states without boxing commissions mostly. Where they didn't test. So there is that possibility. But when he first got HIV, he held a pretty famous, at the time, press conference that was aired live on, I guess it was even CNN. I know it was definitely aired on ESPN. And he seemed remorseful. He did seem like he had it together. Like he understood that HIV was not a death sentence. But he looked back on his life of, reckless permissiveness, as he put it. And he seemed sort of remorseful. And it looked like he might just live with HIV like millions of people did at the time. They had new medications that allowed you to, live in a regular average lifespan at that point. Whereas before, late 80s, early 90s, AZT was a toxic medication. HIV was a death sentence at that time for the most part. But, Tommy did this talk show circuit and he seemed like everything would be okay. He took it seriously. And then as time went on, he decided that the medication was actually killing people and not HIV. So he got caught up in this entire conspiracy theory stuff. And the interesting thing is that AZT was very toxic, so Tommy wasn't completely off his rocker on that point. But by the time Tommy got HIV, there was combination therapy, which limited AZT usage. And so he would have been able to live a relatively normal life from that point on. But he just spiraled into conspiracy theories and if he was around today, he'd probably be a moon hoaxer or a flat earther or baby cannibalizers are in the White House, that kind of thing. And that obviously it hurt him a lot because he refused to take his medication for years.
Yeah, and I don't know that there's really an answer to this, but what do you think that led to that slide into kind of, conspiratorial delusional thinking? Was it the drugs that he started to get into? Was it too many shots to the head? Was it something else?
Well, that's an interesting question because I personally believe that Tommy did suffer from the effects of his short fighting career. It was a short career, but it was violent. He almost got killed by Mercer, as I mentioned. Michael Bent knocked him down 3 times. Lennox Lewis dissected him. He also got knocked down by other fighters, Razor Ruddock, for example. Carl the Truth Williams knocked him down twice. So he took a lot of jolts in his short career. And John Brown, his trainer, told me that even before the Bent fight, the time he got knocked out in 1 round, even before the Bent fight, Brown was worried because Tommy was not taking punches well in sparring. So I do think that he was affected mentally by the damage he took in the ring. And the drugs he started to take, that did not help. That did not help. Because he was taking methamphetamine, marijuana, and then later he added Adderall. And sometimes, like, he mixed them up. I mean, he didn't mix them in one shot or something like that. But, you know, one day it was meth and one day it was Adderall, etc. So I think both those facts led him to spiral downward. And the internet didn't help, I don't think. You know, he already had this idea that he was invulnerable before he got HIV. And so he probably thought he remained invulnerable and that HIV didn't exist or that it didn't cause AIDS and he was okay and the medication was not worth taking. But it proved to be a dangerous mistake.
Yeah, and you know, I'm left wondering, and I felt this way while reading the book, you know, as we discussed, you write in the book, he certainly appears delusional. There's this great anecdote in the book about there was a period when he was running an AIDS foundation for children while simultaneously denying that he was HIV positive. And then of course he refused to take blood tests when he was, you know, trying to make his comeback after, you know, being out of the game for a while after testing positive. Do you think he really believed he didn't have HIV, or was this just all part of the show, all part of his way of trying to get back in the ring and make some more money?
Well, he went through stages. The first stage was HIV was harmless and HIV medication would kill you, which is, you know, it's not only bizarre, but it's sad. And then he actually did get on HIV medication and he acknowledged that he had HIV and that he was living with it. And then finally, for his comeback, when he said he had HIV no longer, I think there was a pragmatic side to it. He was not going to be able to make a living in boxing if he had HIV. And so he claimed that he didn't. I don't think he believed that he didn't have HIV. I think that was part of the show. It was a way to draw attention. It was also a way to get back into boxing, even though there really was no route to that. Boxing in the big time anyway. But he continued with that. It's hard to say what someone like Tommy really believed, because he was a guy who said that he teleported. You know, he bought a cave in 1998, I think, because he thought the world was going to end during Y2K, and he became a doomsday prepper. And he said a lot of crazy things. So it's hard to believe that he didn't think he had HIV, and it's hard to believe that he did think he had HIV. That's the best way I can phrase it.
Right, yeah. I mean, you know, so as we touched on, he tried to make this comeback years after, you know, being diagnosed with HIV. And it was just crazy and fascinating, really, to me to read about the different standards in the various states and, you know, to get sanctioned to fight and how lax many of them were, and, you know, and ultimately how unbelievable it is that a governing body would allow him to get into the ring. Have the regulations become any more unified since then across the various states, or is it still as lax as it was then?
No, it's still pretty haphazard. When Tommy was diagnosed with HIV, some states implemented HIV testing, which they had never had done before. But as when Tommy came back in late 2006, 2007, the states were still like that. You know, there are soft commission states, there are hard commission states in boxing, and there are some states that don't have commissions at all. And Tommy concentrated on soft commission states during his comeback. And that was calculated, I think. And, you know, I don't think boxing will ever have a central authority. It'll never be unified because that'll make it harder for people to make money. And that's ultimately what it comes down to in boxing, is how can we hustle up some money by any means possible, basically, in boxing. Well, you still read about forged medical records once in a while. You still read about, you know, opponents who were not who they say they were, imposters fighting in the ring. I don't think it'll ever improve, to be honest.
You know, through it all, there seemed to be this magnetism to Tommy. You know, despite the HIV diagnosis, despite him clearly, you know, no longer being a serious fighter in the ring, despite the stories of the womanizing and the drug use and, you know, in the later years, arrest after arrest, people still seem to be drawn to him. I mean, you mentioned Dawn Gilbert. She's probably the best example, right? I mean, she kind of came back to him when he was in jail. And despite the fact that he once, you know, took a needle that he had used and plunged it into her and said some of the effect that she has HIV now too. I mean, and she came back to him. So what was it about Tommy that drew people to him to that in that way?
Well, as a public figure, you know, Tommy was soft-spoken. He had the soft charisma to him. He was soft-spoken. He was a good-looking guy. And he was so exciting in the ring that drew people to him. As far as personally, a lot of people said he was a giving guy. He was very generous to his friends, to his family, even to strangers on the street, like, you know, homeless people, down-and-out people, he would give them money. And this AIDS charity thing, which, you know, is sort of a double-edged sword because he didn't believe in HIV, and then he was also part of a foundation. But that was still a good thing. in his heart, his heart was in the right place, I guess. But as far as personally goes, I think there's a question of his fame at the time. And I think people like to be around famous people that rubs off on them or whatever. And he could be a fun-loving person between drug bouts. But it was hard to get anyone to talk about him personally. So it's hard for me to say what was going through Dawn Gilbert's mind. And I don't want to be too judgmental. I mean, you know, she did marry him twice. Once it was a bigamous union, which is pretty odd, right? I mean, and then the other time it was when he was basically just released from jail. So I don't know. I don't want to be judgmental about that. She saw something in him. A lot of women found something in him because, you know, he still kept sleeping with dozens of women after he was diagnosed as HIV positive. So, you know, that's something I can't explain, to be honest. It's pretty crazy when you think about it.
So, of course, you know, his life came to a tragic end. Can you talk a little bit about what his life was like at the end in the last, you know, couple of years?
Well, the book, The Duke, finishes pretty abruptly because the last couple of years of his life, the last year in particular, was pretty, not only is it sad, but it was uneventful. It was basically going from hospital to hospital. And he was basically in a vegetative state. I won't say vegetative, I'll say non-communicative state. He was bedridden, and it really is sad to read about that because that could have been prevented if he had the right people around him. You know, one thing I'll say about his two wives, ex-wives, the Dons, they never, ever made Tommy feel that HIV was not real. They helped him with his medication. You know, they paid for his medication sometimes. They did what they could to help him through HIV. And that wasn't the case later on in his life where he met people who, you know, sort of encouraged his delusions. And that's ultimately where it ended for Tommy. There really isn't much to say about the last couple of years of his life. He faded out of the public spotlight. And the last interview I recall was the interview, I think it was with Sam Mellinger, a journalist. And there Tommy was talking about he was teleporting. He had the powers of teleportation. HIV wasn't real. You know, God was on his side, such and such. So I guess I could have written 20 or 30 more pages, but that would have been depressing for me and for everybody else. You know?
Okay, Carlos, I'll get you out of here with one last question that I like to ask all my guests. First, again, let me say the name of Carlos's book is The Duke, The Life and Lies of Tommy Morrison. And it's really just fascinating. I mean, we touched on some of the anecdotes here, but some of the stuff is just really mind blowing. And he's a fascinating character, and Carlos does a great job of capturing that. So, Carlos, my final question for you is, what is your all-time favorite sports book?
Oh, that's a tough one. I'm going to say, I'll probably get some heat for this, but I'll say John Lardner, White Hopes and Other Tigers. That came out, I think, in 1952 and 1953. The New Yorker had two boxing writers. Most people think that only Liebling was the only boxing writer the New Yorker had. But John Lardner was the other one. And I really enjoy that book because it underscores the absurdity of boxing as well as the tragic side of boxing. And you know, that's something that Liebling couldn't do, in my opinion. The tragic side didn't exist in Liebling. But Lardner really gets that down. I recommend that book. I definitely recommend that book to anybody who's a boxing fan.
Yeah, I'll have to check that out for sure.
Yeah.
All right, Carlos. Well, thank you so much again for coming on. It was really, really fun to talk to you about the book.
Thanks, Paul. I appreciate it.